Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Trauma-informed care, or TIC, is becoming frequently used term for what is considered the gold standard of care for behavioral health and other social agencies. It's become a treatment framework that involves understanding, recognizing, responding to the effects of all types of trauma. TIC can be implemented in any type of service setting or organization, and many disciplines have already created trauma-informed transformation in their programming and service delivery. These have included social service organizations, behavioral and mental health programs, criminal justice agencies, to name just a few. In today's show, we're going to be talking more about what a trauma-informed approach is, why it has become the focus to address trauma's consequences, and facilitate healing. My guests for today's show in the studio with me are Lisa Frazier, Executive Director of the Center for Family Strengthening, or CFS, Sandra Miskovich, did I say that right?
Perfect.
Oh, I'm so proud of myself today. Director of Maternal and Child Health with San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department. And with us by phone is Gabriella Grant, who is the Executive Director of California Center for Excellence for Trauma-Informed Care. And Gabby, can you hear us? Oh, we're bringing in Gabby now. Gabby, are you there?
I'm here.
Hello.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you all for joining me today. So this is going to be a topic that it's bound to be an interesting show. And I think that one of the things we want to do is encourage people, as you're listening, please, you are invited to join our conversation today with your comments and questions by calling area code 805-781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And Gabby, in order to kind of start us off here, can you give me a little bit of an overview of what has been going on to focus a change in cultures of social organizations around the discussion of trauma-informed care and a different approach?
Yeah, brilliant question. And, you know, I think that a couple of things have connected and created this energy in order to create trauma-informed transformation countrywide, nationally. And then we can also talk about California and the Central Coast as well.
Great.
So one of the things is that our social services, our criminal justice system, our healthcare systems, taxpayer-funded systems are expensive and sometimes seem to operate in conflict with each other. And yet, the taxpayer, you and me, have always said, well, you know, there seems to be, you know, kind of similar people who are involved in these systems, or that government should kind of be better coordinated. And then on top of, you know, kind of a broad critique of government service delivery has been our ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and a whole bunch of young people going off to war and then coming back damaged. And our awareness of trauma tends to ebb and flow with wars, whether that was World War II, Korea, Vietnam, you know, and now the Middle East. So I think a couple of things kind of broader, more broadly kind of coalesced in order to do this. Another thing that happened is that substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, especially publicly funded treatments, also were not showing the outcomes that people were expecting, in particular the people who are going through the treatments themselves, their families, their communities. We're seeing a lot of, you know, destruction in terms of substance abuse and mental health issues, and wanted to see a better provision of treatment and services. And yet there was a conflict. So if we go way back to the 90s, the mental health and the substance abuse fields were separate.
Mm-hmm.
And had developed separately, and then they tried to come together under a banner called behavioral health.
Right.
And this, right. this merging was not the smoothest of mergings. Mm-hmm. And some people from the substance abuse treatment field felt that mental health practitioners, often licensed mental health therapists, didn't really understand the lived experience of people who had addiction and who had experienced substance abuse issues. And meanwhile, people who were from the mental health field often felt that substance abuse treatment wasn't evidence-based, was a little bit more perhaps faith-based or individualized or personalized in a way that didn't allow for standardized treatment. So all of these conflicts started to come together. In addition to that, we had in the 1990s a massive amount of population that had been incarcerated, often for mental health and substance abuse issues. Very expensive. Here in California, we had three strikes, you're out, and we were paying a lot of money for these interventions and containment policies. So, you know, along the way, at some point, there was an organization called Community Connections out of Washington, D.C. A woman named Maxine Harris and a man named Roger Fallett started to really see that central to all of these issues was early experiences of trauma. And they developed an intervention in their program in Washington, D.C. to really respond to these basic needs that trauma survivors had, rather than dealing with a specific presentation of a mental health problem or a substance abuse problem or a criminal involvement or child welfare involvement or whatever the system was that was being addressed. And they wrote a book in 2001, a small tome, very readable, called Using Trauma Theory to Design Services. Systems. And this was really the ignition, the lighting mm-hmm. of trauma-informed transformation. And it really took several years for it to kind of venture over here to California. And there was a large-scale federally funded study called the Women with Co-Occurring Disorders and Violence Study that had two locations in California, one in San Joaquin County and one in Los Angeles County. And in 2004, that study completed, and peer-reviewed articles related to the data collected during that study started to come out. And then in 2006, I ended up reading some of these articles, and it was actually in 2006 that I first heard this phrase, trauma-informed services. And, you know, the rest is history, but I'm happy to review that history as well.
Well, yeah, and if you could talk about, you know, because I do think it's really interesting, Gabby, how what your background and training is and how it really interconnected with this trauma-informed system work.
Yes. So I am not a therapist, but I do provide trauma treatment, and I'll definitely talk more about that in a second. My professional background is in public policy, criminal justice policy, and the female offender. I went to Johns Hopkins. I'm a native of California, but I ended up at Johns Hopkins for graduate school in Baltimore, Maryland, where drug addiction, mental health, and criminal justice now are even more an issue, but in the 1990s were very pressing issues in Baltimore. At that time, Baltimore had high rates of incarceration, mm-hmm. primarily of African Americans.
Right.
There was also in Baltimore some of the highest rates of HIV new cases reported, gonorrhea, syphilis. There was really, you know, a public health crisis going on where Johns Hopkins had one of the most premier public health schools really in the world.
And systems,
so,
yeah.
You know, we had some of the best experts in terms of medical and public health research and provision, and yet we had one of the biggest public health disasters on our hands in Baltimore. So it really did not take me as a student, but one or two articles of why do women end up in the criminal justice system before it was pretty clear that in the vast majority of cases, still true today, that early experiences of violence and abuse were the pathway into prison for most women. And still true today, most women who are currently incarcerated have had crimes committed against them that were really much more severe than the crimes that they committed that ended them in prison in the first place. So, you know, a fundamental injustice seemed to be happening. But in the 1990s, there was still this kind of tough-on-crime orientation. And when I attempted, I worked for the Division of Parole and Probation for Maryland, and when I attempted to write some grants, federal grants, to address trauma, domestic violence particularly, in the life of incarcerated women, that really was a thought conflict from a criminal justice perspective. And I was told that those were offenders and we needed to be treating, you know, their offenses and their behavior and things that cause those behaviors, like mental health and substance abuse issues, but they weren't victims. And that there were crime victims, and crime victims were not offenders. And if I was interested, I could work with crime victims. And so I ended up writing grants for crime victims and running the first community corrections victim services program in the country, which showed me something that I don't know that I had realized until I started working with crime victims, which is that crime victims are incredibly dedicated to improving the criminal justice system. They want a system that works, and they want to prevent future crime victimization. And so they're really much more interested in effective outcomes and effective services in the criminal justice system than perhaps the people who are even involved in the criminal justice system are.
The ones providing the services.
So it was a good moral vision of safety and healing that these crime victims really presented to me.
So with if you were to give an overview of kind of a differentiation between how services are typically delivered now in organizations that are funded, federally funded, or, you know, governmentally funded that you're talking about, and something that would be more aligned with a trauma-informed care approach, how would you differentiate those?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, looking at which system, the traditional approach kind of varies because every system kind of developed its own ways of behaving. But broadly speaking, and I can, you know, just kind of bring forward the mental health publicly funded system in California as the traditional model that we can compare, is that a person has to have both serious mental health issues and absolutely no ability to pay for treatment. And so it's a pretty extreme population that even is eligible for treatment.
To access
and as a result
the care.
Of that, there's kind of a culture of scarcity. Mm-hmm. So an individual who is struggling with mental health currently in the state of California needs some sort of eligibility, which is Medi-Cal, Medicaid, Medicare, private insurance to a lesser degree, and really no other resources. In addition to that, they then have to meet some sort of diagnostic criteria, have a serious mental health condition, bipolar disorder, major depression, schizophrenia, all of these kind of things. What this model says is we have to screen you for your eligibility. We have to assess you for your mental health. Then we have to find a provider that is going to be providing you, and there's probably a wait list. So these individuals who are really in sometimes in the most extreme, florid mental health crisis around are put on wait lists after all the screening and all the assessment. Very little treatment comes out. I'm honestly going to say that that's our current mental health system.
And Gabby, but, as you,
you know,
as Gabby, as
that might be an extreme version, but broadly, I think that's the case.
As you describe that, okay, from that aerial view, what that really said to me was you have to have identified the people to access that system as really being at the very lowest tier in desperation and resources in order to access any care.
Yeah. Yeah. And therefore, the message is get extreme.
Yeah.
Either handle it on your own or get extreme. And safety really is not a part of this whole process.
Yeah.
So in contrast, what we would really want to see is, first of all, recognizing that violence is a public health crisis. It's a public health epidemic, and that it affects all kinds of people in all kinds of different ways, and the public is paying for these effects in a disorganized fashion. And instead, what we can actually provide by understanding trauma more broadly, understanding it as a public health issue, is to provide low-cost, on-demand, safety-focused treatment where people already are going, whether that's in the schools, whether that's in the jails, whether that's in primary care offices, whether that's in the library, whether that's in churches. So what we're really seeing that the shift is to help all of these systems where people are going for assistance in any way, that we can be providing a safety-focused, a skills-based, a self-regulatory, public health form of low-cost, high-quality treatment all over the place, and people don't have to get so extreme. And they also don't have to handle it on their own. That it really is a connective way for us to focus on community well-being through safety and self-regulation, and the treatment feels good. It's not painful. It's a good feeling treatment. As a matter of fact, I did a training up in Oakland yesterday, 2 days ago, and the topic was commercial sexual exploitation of children, a pretty heavy topic. And we had a very small group of participants in this training, and so I ended up going to the training department and kind of recruiting an IT guy to come along and kind of bump up the number of people in this mock treatment group. So this guy did not really even know what was going on. He came, and he was a very silent guy. And afterwards, he said, the universe works in mysterious ways, because I had no intention of this, you know, group doing anything for me, and yet it was exactly what I needed to hear for my personal life. So, you know, what it really tells us is that we often have moments of struggle. Our safety is often compromised, whether that's because of our job or our families or our health, and that we can start providing these skills, we can start providing this information in a way that's non-punitive, non-shaming, non-targeted, and really spread it out as a public health campaign.
I'm going to take a real quick break here. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your public radio station. Our topic today is trauma-informed care. And joining me to explain what this means and how trauma-informed care approach differs from the way organizations have typically been delivering services and interacting with clients, I have three guests knowledgeable about the topic. They are Gabriella Grant, Executive Director of the California Center of Excellence for Trauma-Informed Care. Gabby is joining us by telephone. In the studio with me are Lisa Frazier, Executive Director for the Center for Family Strengthening, and Sandra Miskovich, Director of Maternal and Child Health with San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department. If you have a question or a comment, we invite you to join us on the air. All you need to do is call in at 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. Gabby, you mentioned that safety first is kind of described as being the paramount beginning or approach for trauma-informed care. What does that really look like in practice? If you could give an example of a difference between not using safety first as an approach and using it.
Okay, sure, absolutely. And you know, I often say that you know, there's some sacred cows out there that tend to get slaughtered in some of these conversations. So let's get ready for the first one. And the first one is individualized treatment. So the current approach is all about individualized treatment. And then when you ask, what does that mean, individualized treatment? People say, you know, providers say, it depends. You know, it depends on what my client needs. It depends on the issues in my client's life. It depends, it depends, it depends. And, you know, there's really some serious public policy and public health issues with It Depends. So on the first level, I can't give you informed consent with It Depends. You need to tell me what the treatment is before I can give informed consent. So I often get into treatment not knowing what the treatment is actually going to be. I've just been told that I need treatment, or I've been mandated by the courts to get treatment, or my family has threatened me in some way for me to get treatment, or pleaded with me to get treatment, or I clearly need treatment, but I don't actually know what this treatment is because it depends. So really the safety first focus says we all need safety. You need mm-hmm. safety. I need safety. Every single day we need safety. And we need safety not only to function in terms of safe housing and safe transportation and safe communities. I mean, clearly that's the public purpose. But it turns out that our physiological functioning needs safety in order to function physiologically. And that when I do not feel safe, non-consciously, and I'm, you know, sometimes people say I'm safe, you know, I've got some money in the bank and I've got this and that, so I'm safe, but their non-conscious body is not feeling safe for a wide variety of issues, often early child traumatic issues that are still pervasive in the nervous system of that person, and they're not perceiving the safety, and you can have a whole bunch of physical health problems as a result. Broadly speaking, we see research that shows that people who have these early traumatic experiences and have experienced pervasive loss of safety physiologically throughout their lives have higher rates of autoimmune disease, such as diabetes, MS, irritable bowel syndrome, that these individuals often have a very hard time with intimate relationships, are often desirous of having intimate relationships, but can't handle the boundaries and the intimacy that these relationships require. We often see people who are pervasively unsafe thinking that I'll have a family and I'm going to do things for my family in order to create safety for me now, but then often struggle to create safe parenting and safe child-parent relationships. They can become overly protective and actually become unsafe through trying to control their family's safety, or give up and just kind of say, hey, you know, I can't make my kid do anything and not provide any structure at all. We also see that we need safety in order to learn, that for children to be able to sit in a room with other children and learn from an adult, these children's bodies, nervous systems need safety. So the safety first mantra is really allowing people to build an awareness that physical safety and emotional safety are biological needs that need to be met before we can have relationships, go to school, parent, succeed in life. And if we don't have that foundational element of safety, some of the things that we have as goals can end up kind of crumbling around us at the moment when we should be enjoying ourselves and that safe relationship and those successes in life.
When you talk about a culture shift in an organization, it's certainly not something that happens overnight. And it seems that in order for a culture to shift, one has to have an understanding of what the culture that exists is. So how do you assess programs and their design and their policies to look at, or do you, to look at whether or not, you know, there are areas that really need to be challenged and changed, and whether the organization is ready to do that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, again, my professional orientation is a policy orientation. And just yesterday, up in Oakland, another training up in Oakland, there were struggles reported related to how direct staff were working with children who have severe emotional disturbances in a locked non-public school, and that these direct service staff were often getting hurt by the children themselves and what was reported to me is that there was a culture of property destruction in this organization, in this residential program. And I asked, well, what's the policy? You know, what is the policy for staff to adhere to when dealing with children when they're becoming destructive in terms of property or themselves or other people? And once again, I got, it depends. It depends on the behavioral modification plan for each child. And the reality of the situation is that that's not how human beings work. We need a policy. We need structure. We need repetitive, reinforced coaching and supervision so that I have a safety plan to go to when things start to get unsafe. If the answer is it depends on the individual child, well, then it's going to depend on the individual staff person. And we have too much unpredictability, variation in response. And what we saw was, you know, a pretty unsafe situation. And so the first thing to look at is, what is the policy? And there needs to be a policy. It needs to be clear and repetitive and coached and strategized. And then from that basic policy, we can make adaptations and accommodations for the individual. So we're not blind to the policy, but we still have a foundation based in that policy. So is there a policy? That's what I look at first. And then when I see that there is a policy, usually what I end up seeing, whether this is a domestic violence shelter or a homeless shelter or a residential treatment program, is that it's often a whole bunch of rules, and that the program itself doesn't even have a design. The rules are the program. And so basically, you know, you have to, as a client, comply with the rules. And if you're not complying with the rules,
you don't get
services with the program. Yeah. So, for example, just a very, very common domestic violence shelter program rule, and I just want to mention that I worked with 94 domestic violence shelters throughout the state of California, and this was a relatively common rule, which was no contact with the batterer, a no batterer contact rule. And the idea behind it is that the shelter is a confidential location, and if the resident is communicating with the batterer can somehow geolocate this individual or get her to or him to, you know, disclose the location, and therefore, in order to maintain the safety and confidentiality of the shelter, we're going to have this no batterer contact rule. Well, in reality, it was one of the most commonly broken rules. So we have this rule, no contact with the batterer for safety, but residents were contacting the batterer anyway, but they were doing it in hidden ways and in incredibly unsafe ways. And then the residential staff, the shelter staff, became more kind of policing of the residents. Are you contacting the batterer? Give me your cell phone. Let me look at the list of phone calls. Who have you been talking to? Where did you go? And ended up being actually very similar to a batterer, to a controlling abuser. So what's the distinction between the shelter staff that's kind of getting up in my business telling me what to do and an abusive partner that's getting up in my business and telling me what to do? We can't distinguish between safety and unsafety by becoming unsafe. So ultimately, we can look at these rules and see what are the safety aspects of them, get agreements, and recognize the reality of the situation, which is that domestic violence victims often contact the batterer in order to stay safe, in order to manage the leaving process. So how can we agree not to disclose the location, but then to create safety around conversations that the victim is going to have? If you're going to contact the batterer, here are some ways for you to stay safe. If you are going to even meet with the batterer, which often happens as well, here are some ways to stay safe. If you end up disclosing the location of the shelter, please let us know so that we can alert local law enforcement and just stay aware of what's going on. So that we're constantly creating safety instead of using rules in order to be able to control and reject when people behave in ways that we feel they shouldn't be behaving. And so it's really a shift away from using rules and compliance to create an internal sense of safety and agreement, where now the resident says, I want to stay safe, and the people in this program are interested in my safety. I actually don't want to contact this batterer, or if I do contact him, I have some words to use and some safety parameters and guidelines in order to stay safe and protect a service that protects me.
You know, it's interesting because as you went through that whole scenario, it really comes down to it can kind of morph into the rules becoming the program. And there's
right.
more attention to maintaining the rules than there is providing the services or promoting the healing, the self-discovery.
I think
right.
What hit me most when Gabby was talking, it's so much more of an empowerment process when staff facilitate that success of the person gaining that strength and knowledge for their healing. And I think that is what the paradigm shift is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your public radio station at 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas to Paso Robles, 89.5 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at kcbx.org. Trauma-informed care is an approach of delivering services that acknowledges the impact of trauma on an individual and attempts to create a sense of safety within the program, providing services, care, healing, and recovery. My guests today are shedding light on why this transformation is seen as necessary and what is needed for it to occur. I'm joined by phone by Gabby Grant, Executive Director of the California Center of Excellence for Trauma-Informed Care. And in studio with me are Lisa Frazier, Executive Director of the Family First Center for Family Strengthening, and Sandra Miskovich, Director of Maternal and Child Health with San Luis Obispo County. What do you think about our topic today? Do you have some questions or comments? You can reach us at 781-3875 and join our conversation. That's 781-3875. You were talking, Lisa, about, or you were talking, Sandy, about how it really does enable, empower someone to begin to take charge of their own life. When we're teaching them how to maintain safety around themselves, and by modeling that and by creating the space for that, and then to be able to get to a place of moving forward in their life and dealing with some of the issues that are at hand. And one of the things that I was struck with when I was trying to do some research for today's show was it was explained in one YouTube video that I was watching, that it was moving away from an approach of seeing the client as what's wrong with you to what happened to you and how is it affecting you now. So that really enabling there to be a playing field, if you will, of moving forward.
You know, that's so true, because, and it's across all disciplines. Gabby's talked about mental health, behavioral health, the justice systems. I was reading about a school in Washington State, and their disciplinary programs moved toward a trauma-informed care approach, where they were teaching kids to recognize the stress in their life mm-hmm. and then deal with that stress. And they saw such a decline in expulsion and other sort of disciplinary programs, because it really was, again, more facilitating their success, empowering them with skills, and moving beyond this is the consequence of your poor behavior to how can we solve, how can we do something that is going to be a lifelong skill that they'll use, even for kids who have been affected by many childhood traumas.
Gabby, in the work that you've been doing since you first started working with this trauma-informed approach, has differences been seen? Has the effectiveness of this approach been realized?
That's a great question. And you know, I think, you know, if we really focus in on California, what we've got you know, perhaps is both a strength and a weakness in California is 58 county systems and not necessarily a strong state government. And so we really have a lot of experimentation that's going on. And so therefore, you know, I can point to some very interesting things that are happening throughout the state of California. But one of the things that we could benefit from is a more unified statewide leadership approach that allows for standards, funding, training, information to flow rather than relying on 58 separate counties to kind of figure it out on their own, which is kind of what's going on right now. If we're talking about schools, and I'm not even sure how many districts there are in the state of California, but, you know, it's over 100. It might even be, you know, 200 school districts. And each school district is kind of like on its own to figure this out and often reinvent the wheel over and over and over again. So all of that is to say that the data here in California has been under collected. We really need to see some more data. But some of the things that I've seen, for example, here in Santa Cruz, several years ago I did a very brief training, 2-3 hour trainings for school disciplinarians. So this is elementary school principals, middle and high school vice principals, yard guards, some school counselors, substance abuse counselors, and stuff like that. And the approach was really to, first of all, you know, inform them about what trauma is, and I'm happy to give a definition. But ultimately, to look at the behavior that we typically discipline in schools from an it makes sense perspective. It makes sense that you want to protect yourself. It makes sense you want to manage your emotions. It makes sense that you want to leave a bad scene. And that just training these disciplinarians to address kids from what makes sense. What is the core human need being met by getting high, getting into fights, running away, not coming to school, wanting to drop out? Looking at that core human need, which allows for a safe connection between the adult and the child, what we saw in Santa Cruz City Schools was an 8% reduction in suspensions and expulsions with no policy change. If you add a policy change and kind of an expectation that adults are going to use a more humane and safety-focused, agreement-based, respectful approach towards children, holding them to high standards, we see a lot of changes. Kids want to be safe, and they want to see adults in their lives as safe connections. But if adults are punitive and shaming and humiliating and violating, we end up disciplining a whole bunch of people.
And you had mentioned defining trauma. Can you do that?
Absolutely. So generally, when we look from the psychological fields, we get a lot of definitions of trauma. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's some broad consensus about what trauma is, but there is no single definition. Instead, when we look at neurobiology, neurobiology gives us a very clear definition of what trauma is. And these words are directly from SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. And it says, individual trauma is an event, series of events or set of circumstances that is experienced by the individual as threatening or harmful and that ends up having a lasting adverse effect on the person's social, emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being. So these are, I like to think of them as three circles. The first one is that there's an external event, and this external event overwhelms this particular person's capacity to cope and care for self as a result of that event. And that leads to a pervasive loss of safety in the life of the individual. So all of that is to say, the kind of quickest definition to trauma is a loss of safety.
And you had mentioned when we started this show that there's always an upsurge in kind of a post-trauma or trauma following wars. But there we're talking about adults. When we talk about PTSD, wasn't it when the definition or the that particular terminology was accepted in the 80s, it really was pretty much accepted for adults and wasn't defined for children.
Only too true. So the PTSD diagnosis is really, you know, late onset trauma, that the individual experienced safety and then a terrible, terrible thing happened to them. And there's something to go back to. Right. For children, there's, you know, if it's happened early in life, intergenerationally, historically, what are we going back to? More unsafety. So your point is very well taken. I am going to say this, however, which is that the enlisted population in our military today have higher rates of early childhood trauma than the general population. So even when we're talking about vets, and we often think of, you know, the war experiences, to a lesser degree we're kind of becoming ever more aware of military sexual trauma, but what we're not paying attention to are these early childhood experiences in our enlisted forces. So even though it might look like late onset PTSD, I'm going to suggest that there's often this early childhood trauma that's unrecognized and even punished if you talk about it within the VA system, because it's not direct combat or service-related injury.
And you know, when I was looking through the materials related to trauma-informed care, it looked very much to me like we're talking about everybody in the organization being a part of the change in the culture.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say you understand trauma-informed services very well. Nicely done. So trauma-informed services is everybody, from groundskeepers to receptionists to bus drivers to clerical staff to the financial staff to the administration to the management, and then also, of course, treatment staff. So if an organization sends their therapist to a trauma-informed training, that tells you the organization is not trauma-informed, that's the individualized treatment. That's the private practice model. That's the individualized it depends approach. That trauma is a speciality. It's for experts. Only certain people understand this stuff. And that the treatment is so individualized and so confidential and so removed that nobody often knows what's even going on.
Right.
Which, you know, frankly, sounds pretty terrifying. So instead, what we see is that people can create a safe connection with just about anybody.
Yeah.
Why do we have to restrict, of all these publicly funded people, that the person that we're going to tell you who to have a safe connection to, when we know perfectly well that if a bus driver can make your day worse, a bus driver can make your day better, and that we can actually give this safety self-regulation skill set, this information, coaching and supervision to allow for safe connections to happen where people are, and not restrict it so that it kind of drips out almost on a random basis. Who knows who's going to get quality treatment and who knows who's not going to get quality treatment?
Well,
so everybody can become trauma-informed. And as a matter of fact, treatment from a public health perspective is building the skills to cope safely with the effects of trauma, its symptoms, and the unsafe behaviors that overwhelmingly occur post-trauma. And all of us can be providing trauma treatment. Parents can be providing trauma treatment. It's not what we classically, traditionally think of as trauma treatment, but I can build skills all over the place, in the gym, in a musical venue. I mean, it really is something that can be fun, connecting, healing, joyful, and joyous. Treating pain with more pain doesn't seem like a good way to get rid of pain. There's more uplifting and healing and connective ways for us to do this work.
You know, when I hear you talk about that, the thing that comes to mind is if someone goes into a public agency and they're going to see the person, say it's a therapist or say it's a social worker that they're going to ultimately be dealing with, but they have to run a gauntlet in order to get there of people that don't treat them respectfully, smile, give them, you know, give them the time of day, acknowledge their existence, ask them courteously to sit down. that's what you're talking about within the organization. There's, you know, there's, well, it's more than rudeness, right? it's a lack of organization recognizing what's happening with that individual.
Yeah. And now the client, when they see the therapist or the social worker, is complaining about the staff, mm-hmm. not even dealing with the issues of their life. So, you know, it really kind of is a waste of time and money in a lot of ways. And a welcoming environment is definitely something that we want to consider. But the waiting room is a place where skills can be built. So I work with a rural Nebraska agency, and what we have there are some grounding tools and grounding boxes that have a whole bunch of stuff in them, so that while the client is waiting for the therapist or the social worker, and they're coming in agitated, or they become agitated, or any number of different things is happening, the receptionist has this box of grounding items, anything from squeezy toys to bottles with glitter to all kinds of stuff that people can use and actually practice safety and self-regulation. We have 84 safe coping skills on a list that we're constantly handing out and helping people to, I call it eyeballs on the safe coping skills, that we want to actually see, let people see that there's 84 ways to handle situations, that's actually hopeful rather than sit there and be quiet, which is the traditional way. So, you know, we can really start building skills all over the place, even in the waiting room, mm-hmm. not just by creating a welcoming environment and being polite, which,
right.
You know, is a minimum expectation, but that actually in that receptionist area, we're building skills.
Yeah, so you're doing more than just customer service here. What you're doing is you're looking at integrating in the whole organization a way of teaching skills, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, and with that same example from Nebraska, when the receptionists were first given these boxes, they started to become very possessive of these boxes, and they were saying, the clients are stealing the grounding toys in these boxes.
Oh, my God, they'll use them.
You can see how the old school still kind of stays strong.
Yeah.
And instead, we got to say to the receptionists, tell them that they can take whatever they want out of these grounding boxes, that it's there for them. It's so that they can use these skills everywhere in their lives, and not for us to restrict. So I think this is one of the areas that we can see one of the biggest shifts going, that the traditional model is one of scarcity, restriction, eligibility requirements, and it creates a whole bunch of screening and assessment, and we're using a lot of our public money and time to do this kind of weeding out and screening out of people. And instead, the public health approach is really, it's safety is primarily free. Let's give it to everybody. I can't hurt you by building safety. I can't hurt you by focusing on your safety. Let's give it to everybody, not only the people who look like the most extreme cases mm-hmm. of mental health and substance abuse, mm-hmm. Which are often so extreme that even if we build massive amounts of safety, there's still struggles going on.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX FM, Central Coast Public Radio Station, from Salinas to Ventura and around the world at www.kcbx.org. If you're just now joining us and you want to hear today's show in its entirety, will be available on our website at http://kcbx.org/programs/Central Coast Voices. Gabby Grant, Executive Director of California Center of Excellence for Trauma-Informed Care, is with us on the phone. And in studio, Lisa Frazier, Executive Director for Center for Family Strengthening. Sandra Miskovich, Director of Maternal and Child Health with San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department. And we're talking about trauma-informed care, and we have a call from Carol. Carol, are you there?
Yes.
Did you have a question?
Hi.
Or a comment?
Well, I recently I'm a displaced senior after 16 years and having Section 8 was kicked out of my apartment. I was isolating a lot. But the thing of it is, I wish you could speak about when I'm hearing you talk about organizations, it's speaking to me about my very, very terrible negative experiences recently at the Maxine Lewis shelter. and I certainly didn't feel safe there for a number of reasons. And now I have now spent all my saved up deposit money on motel rooms, and for infractions of rules, I was kicked out.
Okay.
But I don't want to go back, and okay. I don't feel safe there. And I wish you could, you're speaking to me about my experiences there and how horribly negative they are, which, by the way, if you speak up about anything and say their mantra is, if you're experiencing negativity, you created it yourself.
I'm going to let Gabby respond to you there. Okay.
And if you know anything about that horrible situation, and I am... the only person right now helping me is a chiropractor I'm seeing, and she last week told me I should get some mental health care, which I know. I've got a lot of issues and childhood trauma issues, and all this you're speaking to me. So thank you so much for this great show.
Okay, thank you, Carol. Good luck.
Please talk about the shelter and what you know about it, and maybe someone else will call in. I don't feel safe talking about it. I may have to go back there.
All right, Carol. All right, I'm going to let Gabby respond here. Gabby, yeah. you've worked with homeless shelters, so what Carol's talking about in terms of feeling safe in a homeless shelter, maybe you can address that.
Yeah, it's pervasive. And, you know, first of all, Carol, I have to say, you know, I send you my sincerest apologies that a publicly funded service did not meet your safety needs. It really is unacceptable. I can't speak specifically to that shelter. I don't know that shelter. But these kind of complaints about homeless, domestic violence, youth, shelters, transitional housing programs are pervasive. The same complaints by people who, you know, have the wherewithal, really the character, the strength of character to speak up, and then they're ostracized, labeled, often called borderline, which is, you know, terrible to say. My apologies. I apologize on behalf of, publicly funded systems that you were not treated in a respectful and safe way. And it exacerbates a person's earlier history of trauma, as Carol mentioned. It exacerbates mental health conditions. If a person has a substance abuse issues, it can exacerbate that. It can exacerbate health conditions. It ends up costing the public purse even more money. And the human suffering. We're just increasing human suffering. It really doesn't ultimately make sense. So, you know, what happens is we've got, again, this idea of scarcity. California has scarce housing. So if we're going to have a shelter, and I'm not speaking specifically for this shelter, I'm speaking broadly for all shelters in California. I'm from Santa Cruz. Right here in Santa Cruz, we have these situations as well. Here's this scarce resource of housing, temporary shelter overnight housing, you know, not even quality housing. And it's scarce, so then, you know, I'm going to have these high barriers to entry. You have to be sober. You have to be compliant. You have to be quiet. You can't have very much stuff. God forbid you have an animal, or children, or adult children, or male children, that who we want to come into this shelter becomes, so it's like a dating profile almost. And then individuals need shelter. It's a human need. So now you put me in a position of having to perhaps lie, what we call lie. And I tell you that I don't have a mental health condition, or I don't have a substance abuse problem, or I don't have a criminal record. And then I come in feeling like a liar, even less safe, and I have to hide myself. We've seen incredible movements away from this approach while increasing safety and improving the design of the program. However, it's difficult because we're spending a lot of money on enforcement, compliance, and control when, at least theoretically, ideally, we could have a much more safety-based approach dealing with people when they're having early symptoms, early struggles, where their safety starts to crumble on them earlier in the scenario, rather than waiting for an extreme situation such as this older adult who is now homeless. and is using all of her scarce resources in order to stay in motels, which are often isolating and can be, you know, kind of dangerous in the cheaper ones as well. So, you know, she is a voice of experience that we actually have to acknowledge and hear and make things better for her, because she's actually speaking for millions of people today.
And it sounds like organizations really need to, rather than hunkering down and becoming defensive or finding ways to justify what they're doing, just relook at what is existing. Not that there's anybody bad involved or anything wrong involved, but that something may have evolved to a system that just isn't working well. And you're coming, Lisa, Gabby is coming to San Luis Obispo, and you want to talk about that?
Oh, I'd love to, and I'm very thrilled to be a partner in this event that we're hosting here in San Luis Obispo on April 15th, Friday, April 15th at Cuesta College. Cuesta College is a partner with us on this as well. And the event, it can be, you can look at it on our website at cfsslo.org. There is a place there to register for the event, and we can answer your questions about any of those details. And I'm very thrilled to be partnering with the Public Health Department and Cuesta College.
Is there a phone number again that someone can call?
Absolutely. 543-6216, area code 805.
And Gabby, we have about 1 minute. What are you going to be presenting?
I'm hopefully going to be able to present information in a way that allows people to see this shift, feel maybe even in themselves what this shift is. And it's a hopeful shift. It's a safe shift. It's creating programs that help people and reduce the costs of these public programs, as a matter of fact. So, you know, I really feel that it's broadly responsive to people in need, such as Carol, who called in, and the taxpayers who are paying for these services and really want these services to be safe and effective, and not situations that actually make the problem worse, only resulting in more public money. So the last thing that I'm going to say is that ultimately this is a public health approach. Just as we put iodine in table salt in order to address thyroid problems and reduce goiters in our society, we really want to put safety in all public services so that people don't have to be identified, disclose, tell their story to who knows how many people before they get a drip, drip, drip of public services. We really want a full faucet. We don't have a drought of safety. Safety can be created just like nitrogen from oxygen. We really want to produce a lot of it all over the place. It only benefits everybody.
Fantastic. And I want to thank all of my guests today. Gabriella Grant, Executive Director for the California Center of Excellence for Trauma-Informed Care. And also to Lisa Frazier, Executive Director for Center of Family Strengthening. Sandra Meskovich, Director of Maternal Child Health with the San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department, and to Carol, who called in with her question and her concern. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Your suggestions for future show topics are always welcome. Please send them to voices@kcbx.org. Next week, please join host Fred Monroe as he's joined by Robert Reyes and Clark Guest in a discussion about Public Safety Realignment Act and the impact it's had on our community. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining us on Central Coast Voices.
Thank you.